Today on Wings, Resistance to Deep Sea Mining, featuring explorer Sylvia Earle.
Earth is alive, not dead. And we're alive because the ocean is alive.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
The deep sea floor has become a highly contested region of the world. Mining companies are eager to scrape up something called nodules that contain various minerals in high demand. Deep sea explorers and other environmentally conscious people are terrified about what damage that could cause not only to the oceans and its inhabitants, but to the climate of the earth. One of the world's most knowledgeable persons about the ocean floor and avid opponent of deep sea mining is longtime deep sea explorer Sylvia Earle. In June 2023, at age 85, she appeared for a fireside chat at the Explorers Club. The event began with a short film for which Earle collaborated with famed cellist Yo-Yo Ma. Here is the evocative soundtrack of that film.
What we are now proposing to do to mine the deep sea floor is permanent loss. What has taken literally millions of years to put into place. Why would we even think about doing such a thing?
Whisper a lot, but I have a whale of a time. I'm a cellist, so I do music, I do sound. You, I don't know, you tell the truth, you find the truth. You're a distinguished scientist, explorer, and witness to the ocean over decades.
I'm first and foremost a human being, curious. I become a scientist, observing carefully.
I see it. Oh, it's the bottom.
Reporting as honestly as I know how what I see, sharing the view as widely as possible, and through it all, just mindful of the miracle that we exist at all. Looking down into the ocean and seeing what looks like stars with all the illuminated life in the deep sea, it's just a privilege to be alive, to be aware of what my species is doing. I feel compelled to share the view that I've been privileged to have as an explorer going into the ocean. Earth is this biogeochemical miracle. It has taken 4.5 billion years for life to make this planet habitable for us. Climate is shaped by the ocean. Phytoplankton generates oxygen, captures carbon. More oxygen is generated from the sea than from the land. If you like to breathe, you'll listen up. The ocean, it's one continuous, living, dynamic system, like an orchestra of life. The greatest wilderness that remains on the planet is the deep sea. We once thought there's nothing down there. It's dark, it's cold, it's high pressure. What could possibly live there? We know now that most of life on Earth lives in the dark. The ocean is full of life, from the surface to the greatest depths. in that space from about 100 meters to 1,000 meters, below where divers can normally go, except in a submarine, there is, around the world, this greatest migration of life on Earth. Creatures from the deep come up to the surface at night to feed on the productivity that takes place in the sunlight, then sink back into the safety of the depths by day. Going down, it gets darker and darker, gets bluer and bluer. Finally, sunlight doesn't penetrate. High seas creatures, turtles, tunas, sharks, whales, these creatures, where do they get their groceries? They dive down into where the action is, this deep scattering layer of life. The deeper we go, the less we know, and the more discoveries or findings.
The heck is that?
Oh my goodness.
We now have a new treaty, a legal framework to safeguard the global commons of the high seas. At the same time, there's another body of the United Nations that is saying there are minerals down there. A few companies, a few countries want to go into the deep sea and tear it apart for manganese nodules. I'm holding history in my hands. It's a manganese nodule. It's not just manganese. And it's just not a rock, although it's pretty dead right now. It's created in the deep sea, in the dark, under great pressure. The weight, 2 or 3 miles of ocean on top of it, slowly extracting the elements of the universe and microbes gradually over thousands of millennia, distilling little bits of the minerals to create what turns out to be a home for creatures in the deep sea. There's an octopus species who chooses manganese nodules as a place to brood her eggs. And I look at this little rock. I want to know, who are your neighbors? Who comes by for a visit? The deep sea, it's on the chopping block. Miners claim that nothing important lives there. It's the biggest land grab in the history of humankind, and it's happening underwater. They want to begin in the Clarion-Clipperton Zone, within the deepest, oldest body of water on Earth. Licenses to destroy vast areas of wilderness are about to be unleashed. Once mining is proved, could spread throughout the seafloor. Hydrothermal vents and undersea mountains are their next targets. You may not realize it, but you and all the rest of life on Earth, we're in deep trouble.
You're talking about the last best chance to save the oceans.
Save ourselves.
That fate, in some ways, rests on the shoulders and decisions to be made in July on only 36 people.
The International Seabed Authority, governed by these 36 individuals, mm-hmm. who clearly have industrial inclinations.
Our journey is to drive the humankind through a wonderful adventure, which is to go very deep in the ocean to extract some minerals that are necessary for human activity on Earth. We are the only one at the moment who have the legitimacy and the authority.
Where's my voice? Where's your voice? Where are the kids?
Yeah.
Where are we represented?
You're talking about disastrous consequences if the oceans stop breathing. Let's then fast forward in time for our grandchildren, everybody's grandchildren. They will be living the consequences of whatever actions we take right now.
Exactly. It's the best chance we've ever got right now. We still have 10% of the sharks. Half the coral reefs are still in pretty good shape. The deep sea is still largely unscathed. But if we allow deep sea mining to proceed, it really puts our existence at risk. No ocean, no us. Harm the ocean, you're really harming us and the rest of life on Earth.
Wow. I feel like No Oceans, No Us should be on a t-shirt.
And this is a work in progress, bringing science, policy, and art together.
On Wings, you're listening to excerpts from an event at the Explorers Club in New York, featuring deep sea explorer Sylvia Earle. Earle was one of the first women admitted to the club some 40 years ago, and is clearly beloved by its other members. The occasion was the June 7th, 2023 launch of something called the Ocean for Ecocide Law Network. The following month, the International Seabed Authority, to which Earle refers in the film, met in Jamaica. The small UN body announced it would not yet issue any extraction permits for deep-sea mining until it finalizes its mining regulations, perhaps sometime in 2025. This temporary pause gives a small window for opponents of the whole idea to ramp up their campaign. Here are more excerpts from what was discussed at the Explorers Club event.
Well, if you kill nature, you kill us as well. Ecocide is people's side, if you will. And making that connection to know what we now know, it's taken us a long time. Our prosperity, our success, as a species has come through the consumption of nature. And in fact, all animals consume the world around them. We don't photosynthesize, so we have to eat something or somebody, or a lot of somebodies. And we consume nature, we call nature natural resources, and they're generally regarded as free for the taking. The air we breathe, the water, the land, the trees, and certainly ocean wildlife. It still has an accounting base of zero. A live fish, what's it worth? It's only a dead fish once you've captured it and marketed it that you can account for it. And clearly there are limits to how far you can go with that, because how much of the ocean, how many creatures that we take for commerce remain in 21st century, in the 2023, as compared to when I arrived on the planet, when there were only 2 billion people, now there are 8 billion people. And our consumption of wildlife on the land, as well as wildlife in the sea, has continued to scale up, not down. But I think we are the luckiest humans ever to arrive, because now we can see the consequences of our actions and relate what we're doing to nature to our own survival, our own prosperity, our own future. Now, if we want to live it up and say, okay, this is it, this will be the last century we have to worry about, 21st century, and then, you know, boom, it's over, then we should keep on doing what we're doing, flat out. Continue to cut the trees, kill the animals on the land and from the ocean. But that's not the expectation, is it? Where we want to go? Don't we want to have a long and enduring, prosperous future for ourselves? And if so, we've got to take care of what makes our existence possible. And we kind of get it for the land. We've been developing conservation codes of behavior and laws, endangered species, not just in the U.S., but we have this concept globally growing. We have to take care of it. But nature mostly has been defined as terrestrial systems. We're just beginning to wake up to the laws of nature. And that means, look at how does the planet work? And like it or not, we are obeying the laws of nature. Can't make this stuff up.
Okay, so nature is really good at organizing itself, but what kind of a job do we do? So Sylvia, we have UNCLOS, the UN Convention of the Law of the Sea.
The U.S. is not a ratified nation.
Among other things. We have BBNJ, the Biodiversity Beyond National Jurisdictions. We have the New High Seas Treaty. Do those work? Aren't those enough? We've got treaties. Doesn't it work? Why are they not protecting nature? Because clearly they are not.
Because nature has a dollar sign on it. Even though we don't account for it properly, we can sell water rights without understanding that all living things need water. And we like to sort of take charge because we can see our need for water. We don't necessarily see the need for nature or the need for other creatures for water as well. So I think there was an excuse to be, call it arrogant or call it ignorant, whatever you want to call it. We did not know until I think we've never known more or better or have the understanding of how we are a part of nature, not apart from it. That there's no excuse anymore. We can't say we don't know. But we have embedded in our society laws that were made when we did not know, did not understand. We have habits. We have cultures dependent on certain, you know, food habits, cultural. I have my mother's cookbook that uses wild goose fat to make molasses cookies. Come on, we don't take wild goose to make molasses cookies anymore. There aren't that many wild geese around. And it wasn't because there's a law, it's because the laws of nature, you know, if you take down to a certain point, you can't have it as a commercial enterprise anymore, or even a, whether it's commerce or individual. We have to adapt to the reality of the 21st century. So, I mean, I wholeheartedly embrace respect for anybody's culture, their habits, and even the laws. But I insist that we just have to look at the reality of what Earth is today. This is not, people tell me sometimes, they say they think I came from another planet, and I said, well, I did. I came from a planet that no longer exists. Doesn't. I mean, I came along just at the edge of the time when wild birds darkened the sky. I can remember, I can hear them as they flew in such numbers. It was like a river of birds over my head. This was in New Jersey, when I was 5 years old. And it, as they traveled across the country, they did what whales do. They fertilized the land, not the sea. And thinking that we're newcomers on these ancient systems that go back, you know, until the beginning of life on Earth, on the, and certainly in the ocean more than on the land. But we are just taking what has taken literally 4.5 billion years to form, and it's only taken us 4.5 decades or so to significantly, certainly 4.5 centuries, go back to the 1500s, when there were 500 million people. 500 million. And already there were signs that we were causing trouble with wildlife. And just track from then to now how much of nature has been lost while we have increased. I mean, almost half of the land is now devoted to agriculture. Almost half of the land. 97% of the ocean is open for extraction of wild animals. Not all of it is taken from all that area, but just we're consuming the systems that have taken so long to form and so quickly causing the decline. So wouldn't we want to protect the systems that keep us alive now that we know? Shouldn't we be flat out saying, how can we look at the laws that exist, the perverse subsidies for killing ocean wildlife, the perverse subsidies that keep agriculture on the land just continuing to degrade the land? But it seems like such a good idea, did at the time, but is it a good idea now? And what can we do about it? Can we change the laws? Can we change our behavior? We need laws, but we also need a change in our attitude.
So, Sylvia, I hear you saying that we need to look at the injury to the ocean in particular as more than just an economic harm. Is that what you're saying?
Duh.
Okay. And so should we be telling people that you have a personal responsibility for the harm you've inflicted, even if everyone can't see it? Is that your sense?
We all make choices every day about what to eat, what to wear, how to travel. You know, everybody says, oh, I'm just one person, what can I do? The problems are so big, but it takes everybody. One person cannot do it all. But times 8 billion, little things add up. And even without laws, we can change our behavior. But we do need the laws to enforce bad behavior, because it only takes a small number of individuals to cause a lot of trouble for everybody. So,
yeah, let's pick up on that. Fish. What fish are caught, Sylvia, using bottom trawling? Sole?
Bless my soul, yeah.
Okay. So, all right, let's think about that for a second. So for those of people who have eaten one of those recently.
Halibut.
There you go. Lovely big halibut. So here's the deal. Bottom trawling destroys the ecosystems there. That's a given. The next thing is it releases greenhouse gases, CO2, more than the entire airline industry. So what do we look at? What's our role as an individual choosing a fish or permitting bottom trawling?
People don't know. They don't. I mean, my beloved National Geographic has done a great series on food. And they talk about chickens, they talk about beef, and they talk about fish. And what's the footprint of these? And talking about carbon, talking about climate. So beef, that's one species, that's cows. I mean, variations on the theme. Chickens, that's basically one species. And fish, that's 33,000 species that we lump together and call them fish. So we don't have Kentucky Fried Bird. Probably chicken. But most of the animals that are cultivated for consumption
are really young. We eat lamb. We don't eat big old sheep. Sometimes you do, but mostly the market is for creatures that taste good, eat plants, and grow fast, and don't mind crowding, and that are hardy. But just imagine growing lions and tigers, putting them in a herd. I mean, you couldn't even find that many lions and tigers. But in the ocean, where are the equivalents? Actually, tuna is far further up the food chain than terrestrial carnivores, because tuna eats fish that eats fish that eats fish. All of them are carnivores. All are eating other animals. Finally, after you get down this twisted food chain over years, not just a matter of months, as you do with chickens and cows and pigs and sheep, maybe a year, sometimes 2 years, but not 10 years or 20 years or 50 years or 100 years. Halibut can be 100 years old. A tuna takes at least a bluefin about 10 years to mature, let alone to be big enough to... We take the big ones. We take the old ones. We take them from deep water where they may be 50, 60 years old. Sharks take on the order of somewhere between 15 and 20 years to mature, and sharks live as long as humans. The largest, longest lived vertebrate that we know about is a shark, the Greenland shark, maybe 500 years old. Wouldn't you like to know their secrets? But we're taking them not just to eat, although that's the primary destination for most ocean wildlife that we don't think of as wildlife. We think of them as seafood, not wildlife. But most of the living space on Earth starts at the surface of the ocean and has an average depth of 4+ kilometers, maximum 11 kilometers. The average depth is about where the Titanic rests on the ocean floor. And I think there's been, and still is, a rather widespread concept that the ocean is rocks and water, salt water. And the water is only useful if we can make it into fresh water, because we use fresh water. But actually, we use salt water a lot more, because the ocean, the living ocean, not just the water itself, but the living ocean, shapes climate and weather, planetary chemistry. There are plenty of places in the universe that have rocks and water. Water is not uncommon in the universe. The ocean is rare, maybe unique. It is unique in that it's filled with life. And so killing the life in the ocean affects the chemistry. It affects the nature of the planet as a whole. It really is the key. Earth is alive, not dead. And we're alive because the ocean is alive.
85-year-old deep-sea explorer Sylvia Earle addressed a 2023 World Oceans Week event at the Explorers Club in New York. With her was John Vermilye, co-chair of Mission Blue. For a video link to the full event, email wings@wings.org. Wings thanks your community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, author of The Gift in the Heart of Language, The Maternal Source of Meaning. The Wing Sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.